This is disc number 14.
Richard wondered if perhaps Shota was right, that he was merely using the concept of the danger Kalin's disappearance represented for the rest of the world as an excuse. He decided that the best thing to do for the moment, until he could think of a better way to get the help he needed, and to buy himself time to gather his courage, to harden his resolve, was to change the subject. "What about this thing?" Richard asked, gesturing vaguely. "This beast that's chasing me." The passion was gone from his voice. He realized how tired he was from the long trek over the pass, to say nothing of the blur of days riding up from the old world. "Is there anything you can tell me about it?" He felt on safer ground with this question because the beast could interfere not only with his search for Kalin, but with the mission Shota was urging him to return to. She watched him for a moment, her voice finally coming much softer, as had his, as if without realizing it they had reached a wordless truce to lower the level of antagonism. "The beast that hunts you is no longer the beast it once was. The beast it was as it was created. Events have caused it to mutate." "Mutate?" Kara asked, looking alarmed. "What do you mean? What has it become?" Shota appraised them both, as if to make sure they were paying attention. "It has become a blood beast." Chapter 41. "A blood beast?" Richard asked. Kara moved close to his side. "What's a blood beast?" Shota took a breath before explaining. "It is no longer simply a beast linked to the underworld, as it was when it was created. It was inadvertently given a taste of your blood, Richard. What's worse, it was given that taste through subtractive magic, magic also linked to the underworld. That event changed it into a blood beast." "So, what does that mean?" Kara asked. Shota leaned closer, her voice dropping to little more than a whisper. "That means that it is now oh so much more dangerous." She straightened after she was sure she had made the intended impression. "I'm not an expert on ancient weapons created in the Great War, but I believe that once such a beast as this one has tasted the blood of its mark in such a way, there is no turning it back ever." "All right, so it won't give up." Richard rested his palm on the hilt of his sword. "What can you tell me to help me kill it then, or at least stop it or send it back to the underworld? What does it do, precisely? How does it know that..."
"No, no," Shota waved a dismissive hand. "You are trying to think of this in terms of some ordinary threat hunting you. You're trying to put a nature to it, trying to give it a defining behavior. It has none. That is the peculiarity of this thing, the absence of a defining description of a makeup, at least one that is of any use, since its nature is precisely that it has none. Because of that, it therefore cannot be predicted."
"That makes no sense." Richard folded his arms, wondering if Shota really knew as much about the beast as she said she did. "It has to function by some fundamental nature. It has to behave in certain ways that we can at least come to understand and therefore begin to anticipate. We just need to figure it out. It can't possibly have no nature."
"Don't you see, Richard? Right from the beginning, here you are trying to figure it out. Don't you suppose that Jagang would know that you will try to figure it out so that you can defeat it? Haven't you done that sort of thing with him in the past? He has figured out your nature, and to counter you, he has created a weapon that, for that very reason, has no nature. You are the seeker. You seek answers to the nature of people or things or situations. To a greater or lesser extent, all people do. Had the blood beast a specific nature, its actions could then be learned and understood. If something can be understood enough to predict its behavior, then precautions can be taken. A plan to counter it can be made. Decoding its nature is essential to effective action being taken. That's why this thing has no nature, so that you can't do those things to stop it."
Richard ran his fingers back through his hair. "That doesn't make any sense.
It's not supposed to. That, too, is part of its trait, to have no trait, to make no sense in order to foil you.
I agree with Lord Rawl, Kara said. It still has to have some kind of makeup, some way of acting and reacting. Even people who think they are being clever by trying to be unpredictable still fall into patterns, even though they may not realize it. This beast can't just run around hither and thither, hoping to come across Lord Rawl napping. In order to prevent it from being understood and stopped, this beast was intentionally created as a creature of chaos. It was conjured to attack and kill you, but beyond that mission, it functions toward that end through disordered means.
Shota gathered up another floating point of her dress as she spoke. Today it attacks with claws. Tomorrow it spits poison. The next day it burns with fire or crushes with a blow or sinks fangs into you. It attacks by random action. It does not choose a course of action based on analysis, previous experience, or even the situation at hand.
Richard pinched the bridge of his nose as he thought about her explanation. So far, it seemed like Shota was right, in that there had been no pattern to the attacks. They had come in completely different ways, so different, in fact, that they had questioned whether or not it was really the same beast Nikki had warned was after him. But Lord Rawl has evaded this beast several times now. He has proven that it can be bested.
Shota smiled at the very idea, as if a child had come up with the assertion. She strolled off a ways and then returned as she considered the problem. The twitch of her brow told Richard that she had come up with a better way to explain it.
Think of the blood beast as if it were rain, she said. Imagine that you want to stay out of the rain, like you would want to avoid being caught by the beast. Imagine that your goal is to stay dry. Today you may be inside when the rain comes, so you remain dry. Another day the rain may come on the other side of the valley, and again you stay dry. Another day you leave an area just before the rain begins. Another day you may decide not to travel, and there the rain visits. Maybe on another day as you walk down a road the rain moves in and falls in the field to your right, but on the road and to your left it remains dry. Each time the random rain event missed you, and you stayed dry, sometimes because you took preventative measures, such as staying inside and sometimes by sheer chance. But as often as it rains, you realize that it will sooner or later get you wet. So you may decide that the best approach in the long run is to gain an understanding of exactly what you are up against. Therefore, in an effort to understand your adversary, you watch the sky and try to learn to predict the rain. Some patterns begin to reveal themselves as relatively reliable, so you use them as a means of prediction, and as a result, there will be times when you are correct and accurately anticipate the approaching rain. By this means, you are able to stay inside when the rain comes, and thus you stay dry. You have succeeded, it would seem, by applying what you've learned about how to anticipate and predict the rain.
Shota's intent, ageless eyes took in Kara, and then fixed on Richard with such power that it almost halted his breathing.
But sooner or later, she said in a voice that ran a shiver up his spine, the rain will catch you. You may be taken by complete surprise. Or you may have forecast that it was coming, but believe that you would have time to be able to take to shelter first, and then it suddenly sweeps in faster than you ever thought possible. Or on a day when you are far from shelter because you thought that on that day there was no chance of rain at all, and so you ventured far from your shelter, it unexpectedly catches you. The result of all these different events is the same. If it is the beast rather than the rain, you are not wet. You are dead. Confidence in your ability to predict the rain will eventually be your downfall because while you may be able to accurately predict it on a number of occasions, it is not in reality reliably predictable based on the amount of knowledge actually available to you or possibly your ability to understand all the information you do have. The more times you escape, though, the stronger your false sense of confidence will become, making you all that much more vulnerable to a surprise event.
Your best efforts to know the nature of rain will eventually fail you, because even if you are right with a number of your forecasts, the things that brought about successful predictions are not always relevant. Yet you have no way of knowing that. As a result, the rain will sneak up and envelop you when you are not expecting it.
Richard glanced at the worried look on Kara's face, but didn't say anything.
The blood beast is like that, Shota said with finality. It has no nature precisely so that you cannot predict its behavior by any patterns to its conduct.
Richard took a patient breath. He couldn't keep quiet any longer. But all things that exist have to have a nature to them, laws of their existence, even if we don't understand them. Otherwise, what you are proposing is that they could contradict themselves, and they can't. Lack of understanding on your part does not mean that you can pick an explanation of your choice. You can't say that since you don't know the nature of it, it therefore has none. You can say only that you don't yet know the nature of this thing, that you haven't yet been able to understand it. With a slight smile, Shota gestured toward the sky.
Like the rain? You may be theoretically correct, Richard, but some things, for all practical purposes, are so far beyond our understanding that they appear to be driven by happenstance, like the rain. For all I know, weather may very well have laws that drive it, but they are so complex and far-reaching that we cannot realistically hope to comprehend or know them. The rain may not truly in the end be an event caused by chance, but it is still outside our ability to predict, so to us, the result is the same, as if it were entirely random and without order or nature. A blood beast is like this. If there are in fact laws to its nature as you believe, it would make no difference to you. All I can tell you is that from what I know, it's a beast created specifically to act without order, and the creation of it was successful to the degree that it functions consistent with having no discernible nature. At least none that is of any use in understanding or stopping it. I grant the possibility that you may be right. I suppose it's possible that there is some complex nature behind the beast's seeming disorder. But if that is the case, I can tell you that it is so far beyond our ability to understand that for our purposes, it functions by chaos.
I'm not sure I understand you, Richard said. Give me an example.
For instance, the beast will not learn from what it does. It may try the same failed tactic 3 times in a row. Or it may try something even weaker the next time that obviously has no chance of success. What it does appears random. But if it is driven by some grand, complex equation, it is not revealed through its actions. We see only chaotic results. What's more, it has no consciousness. As we would think of it anyway, it has no soul. While it has a goal, it doesn't care if it succeeds. It doesn't get angry if it fails. It's devoid of mercy, empathy, curiosity, enthusiasm, or worry. It was given a mission, kill Richard Rawl, and it randomly uses its myriad abilities to achieve that goal, but it has no emotional or intellectual interest in seeing its purpose accomplished. Living things have self-interest in seeing themselves succeed at their goals, whether it's a bird flying to a berry bush or a snake following a mouse down a hole. They act to further their life. The blood beast does not. It's just a mindless thing advancing toward the completion of its built-in conjured objective. You might say it's like the rain, given the mission of get Richard wet. The rain tries and tries, a downpour, a drizzle, a quick shower, and all fail. The rain doesn't care that it failed to get you wet. It may idle itself with a drought. It doesn't get eager or angry. It doesn't redouble its efforts. It will just go on raining in different ways until eventually it drenches you. When it does, it will feel no joy. The beast is irrational in that sense. But make no mistake, it is vicious, fierce, and mindlessly cruel in its actions.
Richard wearily wiped a hand across his face. Shota, that still makes no sense to me.
How could it be like that? If it's a beast, it has to be driven by purpose of some sort. Something has to drive it.
Oh, it is driven by something, the need to kill you. It was created to be a creature that acts with pure disorder so that you may not counter it. In a way, you have proven yourself to be an opponent so difficult to defeat that Jigang had to come up with something that would work by avoiding your striking abilities rather than overpowering them.
But if it was created to kill me, then it has purpose.
Shota shrugged. True enough. But that one bit of information is of no use to you in predicting how, when, or where it will try to kill you. As you should know by now, its actions toward that goal are random. You should clearly see the profound danger in that tactic. If you know the enemy will attack with spears, you carry a shield. If you know that one assassin with a bow is hunting you, you can have an army search for a man with a bow. If you know a wolf is hunting you, you can set a trap or stay indoors. The blood beast has no preferred method of killing or hunting. So from the standpoint of defending yourself from it, it's profoundly difficult to protect against. One day it may attack and easily kill 1,000 soldiers who are protecting you. The next time, it may timidly withdraw after mauling a single child who toddles in front of you. What it does one time can tell you nothing about what it will do the next time. That, too, is part of the terror engendered by such a beast, the terror of not knowing how the attack will come. Its strength, its lethality, is that it isn't anything in particular. It isn't strong or weak or fast or slow. It's constantly changing, yet it sometimes stays the same or reverts to a previous state, even an unsuccessful one. The only thing that mattered after it was created was the first time you used your gift. That's when it locked on to you. After that, you can never know what it will do next or when it will do it. You know only that it's coming for you, and no matter how many times you escape its clutches, it will continue to come. Maybe several times in the same day, maybe not again for a month or a year, but you can be sure it will eventually come after you again. It will never quit. Richard wondered how much of what Shota was telling him she knew to be fact, and how much she was filling in with what she thought, or maybe even imagined.
But you're a witch woman, Kara said. Surely you can tell him something that will help counter it.
Part of my ability is the capacity to see how events flow in the river of time, to see where they're going, you might say. Since the blood beast cannot be predicted, it, by that practical definition of its character, exists outside my ability to predict. My ability is linked in a way to prophecy. Richard is a man who, in a way, also exists outside prophecy, a man others often find frustratingly unpredictable, as the Mord Sith have no doubt discovered. With this beast, I can offer him no advice about what might happen or what he must avoid.
So then, books of prophecy would be of no use? Richard asked.
Just as I am blind to it, so is all prophecy. Prophecy cannot see a blood beast any more than it can see any chaotic chance event. Prophecy may be able to say that a person will be shot with an arrow in the morning of a day that it will rain, but prophecy cannot name every day it will rain, or which of those days that it does rain the arrow will precede it. You might say that the most prophecy can predict is that sooner or later it will rain and you will get wet.
With his left hand resting on his sword, Richard nodded reluctantly.
I have to admit that's close to my own views on prophecy, that it might be able to tell you that the sun will rise tomorrow, but not what you will choose to do with your day.
He frowned at her. So you can tell me nothing about what this blood beast will do because your ability is with the flow of time.
When she nodded, he asked, So then how do you seem to know so much about it?
The flow of events through the river of time is not my only ability, she said rather cryptically.
Richard sighed, not wanting to argue with her. So that's all you can tell me then?
Shota nodded.
That's all I am able to tell you about the blood beast and what such a thing holds for you. If it continues to exist, sooner or later, it will likely get you. But because it's not predictable, even that outcome is not able to be predicted. When, where, or how soon it will get you is impossible to know. It may be today, or for all I know, it may be that before it is able to find you and kill you, you will first die of old age.
Well, there is that possibility then, Richard muttered.
Not much to lay your hopes on, she said in a sympathetic tone. As long as you live, Richard, as long as blood pumps in your veins, the blood beast will hunt you.
Are you suggesting that it finds me by my blood? The way a heart hound is said to be able to find a person by the sound of their beating heart?
Shota lifted a hand, as if to forestall the notion. Only in a manner of speaking. It has tasted your blood in a sense, but your blood, as you are thinking of it, is not what is meaningful to this beast. What is material is what it sensed from that taste, your ancestry. It already knew that you live. It was already hunting you. Your use of your gift the first time was enough to bind it to you for all eternity. It is the gift carried in your blood that it sensed and that caused it to change.
Richard had so many questions he didn't know what to ask first. He started with what he thought might be the easiest to understand. Why is it linked to the underworld? Is there a purpose for that?
A couple that I'm aware of. The underworld is eternal. Time has no meaning in eternity. Therefore, time means nothing to the beast. It will feel no urgency to kill you. Urgency would make it act with a kind of conscious intent that would give it a nature. It feels no pressure with every setting sun to finish the job. One day is the same as the next. The days are never ending. Because it has no sense of time, it needs no nature. Time helps give dimension to every living thing. It allows you to put off chores that you know can be done later. It makes you rush to set up camp before it gets dark. It makes a general act to get his defenses in place before the enemy arrives. It makes a woman want to have children while she still has time. Time is one element that helps shape the nature of everything. Even a moth that emerges from its cocoon to live a life with wings for only a single day must mate in that day and lay eggs, or there will be no more of its kind. The beast is untouched by time. A constituent element of its makeup is the eternity of the underworld, which is antithetical to the very notion of creation, since the underworld is the undoing of creation. That mix, that internal conflict, is part of the driving mechanism which churns its actions and makes it chaotic. When Nikki used subtractive magic to eliminate your spent blood, the beast, from its roots in the underworld, got its taste of you, or more accurately, a measure of your magic. Your blood carries both additive and subtractive magic. The beast was created to be able to know you by your essence, magic, thereby allowing it to transcend typical worldly limits. The beast needed you to use magic the first time so that it could link to you. Through that link, it could hunt you. But when it received that taste of your blood, it became able to know you in a whole different way. The unique element of magic carried in your blood, inherited from Zed's side and from Dark and Rawl's side, is what the beast tasted. That taste is what mutated it from the beast that Jagang's minions created. It's not your blood itself that it senses, but rather it detects those elements of magic inherent in it. That's why any use of magic will draw the beast. That's how it became more dangerous. It now recognizes any use of your magic anywhere in the world. Each person's magic is unique. The beast now knows yours. That's why you must not use your gift. For this very reason, the sisters who brought the beast into existence for Jagang would have loved to have been able to use your blood in the beginning, but they had no way of getting any. They could link the beast to your gift, but without your blood, it was a weak link that didn't really know the full measure of your magic. Nikki gave the beast what it really needed right after it had been awakened by your first use of the gift. She may have done it to save your life, and she may have had no choice, but she did it. Now any use of magic can much more easily bring the blood beast to you. It would seem that Nikki has, in a way, fulfilled her oath as a sister of the dark. The hair at the back of Richard's neck had lifted. He wanted to think of a way to prove Shota wrong, to find a chink in the armor of the monster she had given shape to in his mind. But the beast has attacked when I wasn't using magic. Just this morning it attacked at our camp. I wasn't using magic. Shota gave him one of those looks that had the power to make him feel hopelessly ignorant. You were using magic this morning. I wasn't, he insisted. I was asleep at the time. How could I be using... Richard's words trailed off. His gaze wandered to the distant hills of the valley and the mountains beyond. He remembered waking up and having that terrible memory of the morning Kaelin had disappeared, and then realizing that he was holding the hilt of his sword, its blade drawn halfway from its scabbard. He remembered feeling the sword's stealthy magic coursing through him. But that was the sword's magic, he said. I was holding the sword. It wasn't my magic. It was your magic, Shota insisted. Using the sword of truth calls its power, which joins with your gift, your magic, which is recognized by the blood beast. The sword's magic is part of you now. Using it will chance calling the beast. Richard felt like everything was pressing in on him, closing off every option, shutting off his ability to do anything to stop what was coming for him. He felt the way he had earlier when he woke up to find himself in an ever-tightening trap. But the sword will help me fight it. I don't know how to use my gift. The sword is the one thing I can count on. It's possible that in some instances it may save you. But because the blood beast has no nature and because it is now a part of the underworld, there will be times when you think your sword will protect you, and it will not. Thinking you can predict the ability of your sword to work against the beast will beguile you into having false confidence. As I told you, the beast can't be predicted. So there will be times when your sword can't protect you. You must guard not only against false reliance on your sword, but on it unwittingly calling the beast. It's always hunting you and could attack at any time, but when you use your gift, it vastly increases the ability, and therefore the likelihood, of the beast initiating an attack. Magic baits it. Richard realized that he was gripping the hilt of the sword so hard in his fist that he could feel the raised letter of the word truth pressing into his palm. He could also feel the sword's anger urgently trying to steal into him to protect him against the threat. He took his hand off the hilt as if it were burning him. He wondered if that magic had ignited his own, if he had just called the blood beast without even realizing what he was doing. Shota clasped her hands. There is something else. Richard's attention returned to the witch woman. Great. What next? Richard, I'm not the one who created this beast. I'm not responsible for its danger to you. She looked away. If you wish to hate me for telling you the truth and want me to stop, then say so and I will stop. Richard waved an apology. No, I'm sorry. I know it's not your fault. I guess I'm just feeling a bit overwhelmed. Go on, what were you going to say? If you use magic, any magic, the blood beast will know it. Because it acts in a random manner, it very well may not use that magic link to come after you right then. It may inexplicably not respond, but the next time it may pounce. So you dare not gain confidence in that manner.
You already told me that.
Yes, but as of yet, you have not realized the full implications of what I'm telling you. You must understand that any use of magic will give the beast the scent of your blood, so to speak.
Like I said, you told me that.
That means any use of your gift. When he stared at her with a blank look, she impatiently tapped a finger to his forehead. Think. When he still didn't understand, she said, That includes prophecy.
Prophecy? What do you mean?
Prophecy is given by wizards who have the gift for prophecy. An ordinary person who reads prophecy will see only words. Even the sisters of the light, guardians of prophecy though they thought they were, do not see prophecy in its true state. You are a war wizard. Being a war wizard merely means that your gift carries a variety of latent abilities. Part of that is that you are able to use prophecy to understand it as it was intended. Do you see? Do you see how easy it is to inadvertently use your gift? It doesn't matter how you use your gift. If you use your sword or heal with your gift or call down lightning, it doesn't matter. It will call the beast. To the blood beast, any use of your gift is the same, a means of recognition. It will not distinguish between a small use or a spectacular use. To the beast, the gift is the gift. Richard was incredulous. Do you mean to say that if I simply heal someone or draw my sword, it will alert the beast to me? Yes, and likely in short order, while it knows precisely where you are. Being that it's elementally subtractive, it exists only partially in this world, so while the beast is not hampered by things such as distance or obstacles, it also doesn't function in this world with ease. It can't fully conceive of the laws of this world, such as time. Still, it doesn't get tired, it doesn't get lazy or angry or eager. By all this, I do not mean to suggest that because you use your gift, the beast will therefore act. As I've said, its actions can't be predicted. So like everything else, the use of magic cannot be used as a predictive factor. It only means that it increases its ease in being able to find you. Whether or not it will do so is not knowable.
Great, Richard muttered as he went back to pacing. How can he kill it? Kara asked.
It isn't alive, Shota said. You can no more kill the blood beast than you can kill a boulder that is about to fall on you or kill the rain before it has a chance to get you wet.
Kara looked as frustrated as Richard felt. Well, there has to be something that it's afraid of.
Fear is a function of living things.
Maybe, then, something it doesn't like. Shota frowned.
Doesn't like?
You know, fire, water, or light. Something it doesn't like, and so avoids.
Today it might choose to avoid water. Tomorrow it might slither up from a bog, snatch his leg and drag him under the water to drown him. It moves through this world as it would through an alien landscape that has little effect on it.
Where in the world could someone learn how to create such a beast? Richard asked.
I believe that the core of the knowledge was discovered by Jagang in ancient books on weapons that originated during the Great War. He is a student of ancient subjects having to do with warfare. He collects such knowledge from all over. I have a suspicion, though, that he took what he found and added specifications he wanted in order to defeat you. We do know that he then used the gifted sisters to spawn the beast. Since they used subtractive magic along with their stolen wizardry, they were able to make use of other gifted people as constituent parts of the beast, ripping their souls from them, ripping away all but what was needed in order to conjure, combine, and create the beast. It is a weapon beyond anything we have ever encountered before. Jagang is the one who caused the beast to be created. He has to be stopped before he creates anything else.
I couldn't agree more, Richard muttered.
You can't stop him if you are off chasing phantoms, Shota said.
Richard halted his pacing and stared at her. Shota, you can't just tell me all this without at least telling me something that will help.
You are the one who came to me asking questions. I did not go looking for you. Besides, I have helped you. I told you what I know. Maybe by using the information you now have, you can live another day.
Richard had heard enough. The blood beast had no nature. But not to have a nature, in a way, was its nature. So it had one, as far as he was concerned. It may be true, as Shota had said, that there was no accurate way to predict what it would do next. But lack of understanding or knowledge did not constitute a lack of nature. It was, however, a point that was not worth arguing. He thought that it might be an important distinction sooner or later, but right then it didn't matter much. Everything Shota had said largely confirmed what Nikki had already reported. While she had added facets and details that Nikki hadn't known about, Shota hadn't provided any solutions. In fact, it seemed to him that she had gone to a great deal of trouble to make sure she had painted a hopeless picture. Richard almost rested his hand on his sword. He stopped and ran his fingers through his hair instead. He was at his wit's end. He turned and stared off at the trees spread across the valley, their leaves shimmering in the late-day sun. "So there is nothing I can do to protect myself from the blood beast?"
"I didn't say that."
Richard spun back around. "What? You mean there is a way?" Without emotion, Shota studied his eyes.
"I believe there is one way to keep you alive."
"What way?"
She clasped her hands, twining her fingers together. She looked down at the ground a moment, as if considering, and then met his gaze with steady resolution. "You could stay here."
He saw Samuel come to his feet. Richard returned his attention to Shota's waiting gaze. "What do you mean I could stay here?"
She shrugged, as if it were a trivial offer. "Stay here and I will protect you."
Kara straightened, her arms coming unfolded.
"You can do that?"
"I believe I can."
"Then come with us," Kara suggested. "That would solve the problem." Richard already didn't like Kara's idea.
"I can't," Shota said. "I can only protect him if he stays here in this valley in my home."
"I can't stay," Richard said, trying to make it sound casual. Shota reached out and gently grasped his arm, not allowing him to so easily dismiss the issue.
"You can, Richard. Would it be so bad staying with me?"
"I didn't mean it that way."
"Then stay here with me."
"For how long?" Her fingers tightened ever so slightly, as if she feared to say it, feared his reaction, but at the same time was steadfast in her course.
"Forever."
Richard swallowed. He felt like he'd walked out onto thin ice without realizing it, and now he found that it was a long, long way back to safety. He knew that if he said the wrong thing, he would be in over his head. His flesh tingled as he realized how dangerous the late-day air had suddenly become. At that moment, he wasn't sure that he wouldn't rather face the beast than Shota's scrutiny. Richard spread his arms, as if to ask her understanding.
"Shota, how can I stay here? You know that there are people counting on me, people who need me. You said so yourself."
"You are not the slave to others, chained to them by their need. It's your life, Richard. Stay and have a life."
Kara, looking more than suspicious, tapped a thumb to her own chest. "And what about me?" Without looking over at Kara, without taking her gaze from Richard's, Shota said,
"One woman in this place is enough."
Kara glanced between Richard and Shota as they stared into each other's eyes. But she then did what Richard had earlier advised. She turned cautious and said nothing.
"Stay,"
Shota whispered intimately. Richard could see a terrible kind of vulnerability laid bare in Shota's eyes, in her hungering expression, an open look he had never seen on her before. From the corner of his eye, he could also see Samuel glaring at him. Richard tipped his head, indicating her companion.
"And what about him?"
She did not shy from the question. In fact, she seemed to have expected it.
"One seeker in this place is enough."
"Shota!"
"Stay, Richard,"
she pressed, cutting him off before he could turn her down, before he crossed a line he hadn't known was there until right then. It was both an offer and an ultimatum.
"But what about the blood beast? You said yourself that you can't know its nature. How can you know that we would be safe here if I stayed? A lot of men near me were killed when the beast attacked the first time."
Shota lifted her chin.
"I know myself, know my abilities, my limits. I believe that I can keep you safe here in this valley. I can't be completely certain, but I sincerely believe it to be true. I do know that if you leave here, you will have no protection. This is your only chance.
He knew that the last part had more than one meaning.
Stay, Richard. Please, stay here with me.
Forever.
Her eyes brimmed with tears.
Yes, forever. Please stay. I will take care of you forever. I will make sure you never regret it or ever miss the rest of the world. Please.
This was not Shota, the witch woman. This was simply the woman, Shota, desperately laying herself open to him in a way she never had, offering her unprotected heart, taking a chance. The naked loneliness he saw there was terrifying. He knew because he felt the same anguish of being so alone that it hurt. Richard swallowed and took the step out onto the ice.
Shota, that's probably the kindest thing you've ever said to me. To know that you respect me enough to ask such a thing means more to me than you will ever understand. I have more respect for you than you know. That's why when I needed answers, I thought of no one but you. I sincerely appreciate all you are offering, but I'm afraid I can't accept. I have to go.
The look that came to her face made Richard go as cold as if he had been plunged into icy water. Without another word, Shota turned and started away. Chapter 42. Richard caught Shota's arm, stopping her before she could leave. He couldn't allow it to end in this way, for more than one reason.
Shota, I'm sorry, but you said it yourself. It's my life to live. If you consider me, even a little, to be a friend, someone you really do care about, then you would want me to live my life as I think I must, not as you might wish I could.
Her chest heaved.
Fine. You have made your choice, Richard. Leave. Go and live what is left of your life. I came to you because I need your help.
She turned around fully toward him and cast him as forbidding a look as he had ever seen on anyone. It was the unmistakable mask of a witch woman. He could almost see the air around her sizzling.
I have given you help, gained through an effort on my part that I seriously doubt you can begin to imagine. Use that help as you wish. Now, leave my home.
As much as he wanted right then to do as she asked, as much as he wanted not to press her, he had come for a reason and she had not yet addressed it. He wasn't leaving until she did.
I need your help to find Kaelin.
Her look turned even colder.
If you are wise, you will use the knowledge I have given you to stay alive as long as you can to help defeat Jigang, or to go chasing after phantoms, I don't care which anymore, just go before you find out why wizards fear to come into my home.
You said that your ability helps you see events in the flow of time. What does your ability see about me in the future? Shota was silent for a moment before she finally glanced away from his steady gaze.
For some reason, the river of time has become obscured to me. It happens.
Her gaze returned, more determined than ever.
You see, I can be of no further help. Now go.
He was determined not to allow her to dodge the issue. You know that I came here for information, for something that could help me find out the truth about what's going on. This is important. It's important to more people than just you or me. Don't close yourself off from me like this, Shota, please. I need your help.
She arched an eyebrow. Since when have you ever followed anything I've ever told you?
Look, I admit in the past I haven't always agreed with everything you've had to say, but I wouldn't be here if I didn't think you were an astute woman. While some of the things you've told me in the past were true, if I would have done things strictly your way without using my own judgment as the situation developed, I would have failed. And we would all be either under the rule of Darken Rawl or in the merciless embrace of the Keeper of the Underworld.
So you say.
Richard lost his indulgent tone as he leaned toward her.
You do remember the time you came to see me at the Mud People's Village, don't you? The time you begged me to close the veil so that the Keeper wouldn't have us all? You do remember telling me how much the Keeper wanted those with the gift, wanted you, a witch woman, to suffer unimaginably for all eternity? He jabbed her with a finger, punctuating his points. You did not suffer all the frightful things necessary to stop what was happening. I did. You did not have to fight the Keeper's terrors to close the veil. I did. You did not save your own hide from the Keeper of the Underworld. I did. She was watching him from under her lowered brow.
I remember.
I succeeded. I saved you from that fate. You saved yourself from that fate. That it saved me as well was not your purpose, merely a side consequence. He let out a breath, trying to be patient. Shota, I know that you must know something about this, something about what's happened to Kaelin. I told you I don't remember any woman named Kaelin. Yes, and the reason is that something is terribly wrong, and I realize that because of that, you don't recall her. But you must know something that will help me in my search for the truth. Some bit of information that will help me find out the truth about what's really going on. And you expect that you can just walk uninvited into my home, put my life at risk, do your little dance, and get whatever part of my life, my ability, you want for yourself? Richard stared at her. She had not denied that she knew something that might help him. He realized that he had indeed been right about her. Shota, stop posturing and stop acting like I'm unfairly making demands of you. I've never lied to you, and you know it. I'm telling you that this is important to you, too, whether or not you yet realize it. For all I know, it could yet be something the Keeper has initiated in order to get us all. I need whatever information you can give me to prevent the success of whatever it is that's going wrong. I'm not playing games. I will have what you know.
And you think that such a demand entitles you to it?
Her eyes narrowed. You think that just because I have something, your perceived need means that I must surrender whatever I have? That you are entitled to any part of my life you feel you need? You think that my life is not mine, but I am merely meant to serve you? You think my life means nothing but to be at your disposal when you deign to have use of me? You think you can come in here and make demands, but when I dare ask for something, you get indignant?
I wasn't indignant,
he said, trying to restrain his tone. I appreciated the sincerity of your offer. I understand very well the empty feeling of being alone. But if you're the woman I believe you are, you wouldn't want me even though my heart wasn't in it. You deserve to have someone who can love you. I'm sorry, Shota, but I can't lie and tell you that I can be that one for you, or I would only in the end be hurting you worse. I can't lie to you. I'm already in love with someone. And even if you already realized that, would you really want someone who was so casually unfaithful as to just take up such an offer on the spot? I think what you really want is your equal, a true partner in your life, someone with whom to share the wonders of life. I don't think you really want the empty reward of a lapdog. I think you already know that a lapdog can bring you no real joy. If you care about me, if you made such an offer because you really care, if you were sincere, then help me. She didn't look like she intended to answer, so he pressed on. Shota, I need to know any information you can give me. It's important as it was to you when you came to ask me to seal the breach in the veil. I don't know enough to solve this problem. If I fail, I fear we will all lose. I don't have time for games. I need the information you have. How dare you make such an arrogant demand of me? I've already told you, already given you my answer. It's my ability, my life. You have no right to it. Richard pressed his thumb and middle finger to opposite temples as he took a calming breath. He grudgingly realized that maybe she had a point. He turned his back to her and walked off a few paces as he considered what he might do.
One thing he knew for certain, he wasn't leaving without every bit of help available.
You're saying, then, that you know something that would help me in my search for the truth.
I know a lot of things about a lot of different areas of the truth.
But you know something that I need in order to find the truth about what brought me here to see you.
Yes.
He knew it. And with his back still to her, he said, "Name your price."
"You would not be willing to pay the price."
He considered the price he expected her to revisit. Richard turned to her. She was watching him in that way that made him feel transparent. He was not leaving without the information, and that was all there was to it. This was Kaylin's life. Whatever he had to do to save her life, including giving up his, he would do. "Name your price."
"The Sword of Truth."
The world seemed to stop.
"What?" "You asked the price for what I can tell you. The price is the Sword of Truth."
Richard stood paralyzed. "You can't be serious." The corners of her lips curled ever so slightly.
"Oh, but I am."
Off through the trees, Richard saw Samuel stand up, suddenly very attentive. "What do you want with the sword?"
"You asked the price. I named it. What I want with the payment after it has been made is not your concern."
Richard felt sweat trickle down between his shoulder blades.
"Shota."
He couldn't seem to make himself move or speak. This was not at all what he had expected. Shota turned her back and started for the road.
"Goodbye, Richard. It's been nice knowing you. Don't come back."
"Wait." Shota paused to look back over her shoulder, waves of her auburn hair glistening in a streamer of golden sunlight.
"Yes or no, Richard, I have given you enough of myself for nothing in return. I will give you no more. If you want this, you will pay for it. I will not offer you the chance again."
She watched him a moment and then started to turn away again. Richard gritted his teeth. "All right." She paused.
"You agree, then?"
"Yes." She turned fully around to face him, waiting. Richard immediately reached up to pull the baldric off over his head. Kara jumped in front of him and seized his wrist in both her hands.
"What do you think you're doing?"
she growled. Her red leather glowed in the low sunlight, as if to match the fire in her eyes.
"Shota knows something about this whole mess," he told her. "I need to know what she can tell me. I don't know what else to do. I don't have any choice."
Kara let go of his wrist with one hand to press her fingers to her forehead as she tried to gather her senses, tried to calm her sudden rapid breathing.
"Lord Rawl, you can't do this. You can't. You're not thinking clearly. You're swept up in the passion of the moment, the passion of wanting something you think she has. You've got it in your head that you have to have it no matter what. You don't even know what she's offering. As angry as she is at you, it's most likely that she has nothing of any real value. I have to know something that will help me find the truth. And there is no assurance that this will. Lord Rawl, listen to me. You're not thinking clearly. I'm telling you, the price is too high."
"There is no price too high for Kaylin's life, especially if the price is merely an object."
"This isn't her life you would be buying. It's just a witch woman's word that she can tell you something useful. A witch woman who wants to hurt you for rejecting her. You said yourself that nothing she's ever told you before ever turned out to be the way she said. This will be no different. You will lose your sword, and it will be for nothing of value."
"Kara, I have to do this."
"Lord Rawl, this is crazy."
"And what if it's me that's crazy?"
"What are you talking about?
What if all of you are right, and there really isn't any Kaylin? What if I'm crazy? Even you think I am. I need to know what Shota can tell me. If I'm wrong about everything I believe, then what good is a sword going to do a crazy man? If all of you are right that I'm delusional, then what good can I do anyone else?
What good am I to anyone if I'm crazy? What good am I at all?
Her eyes looked liquid.
You're not crazy.
No? Then you believe there really is a woman named Kaylin and I'm married to her? When she didn't answer, he pulled her other hand off his wrist. I didn't think so.
Kara turned angrily to Shota, pointing with her Ajeel. You can't take his sword. It isn't fair and you know it. You're taking advantage of his condition. You can't take his sword.
The price I asked is but a trifling. The sword isn't even his. It never was.
Shota beckoned with a finger. Samuel, watching from the shadows, scurried toward them through the trees. Kara stepped between Richard and Shota.
It was given to Lord Rawl by the First Wizard. Lord Rawl was named to the post of Seeker and given the Sword of Truth. It's his.
And where do you suppose the First Wizard got the sword in the first place?
Shota pointed a finger tipped with a long red lacquered nail downward at the ground.
He got it here. He came here, into my home, and stole it. That's where Zed got the sword.
Richard doesn't carry it by right, but by theft. Giving it back to its rightful owner is a small penance to pay for what he wants to know.
Kara had a dangerous look in her eyes as she lifted her Ajeel. Richard gently grasped her wrist and lowered her arm before she started something that he knew could quickly turn ugly. He wasn't sure of the results of such a confrontation, but he dared not risk losing what Shota could tell him. Or Kara.
I'm doing as I must, he told Kara in a calm voice. Don't make this any more difficult than it already is.
Richard had seen Kara in every sort of mood imaginable. He'd seen her happy, sad, disheartened, resolved, determined, and enraged. But until that moment, he had never seen her anger focused so intently, deliberately, so directly at him. And then he had a sudden vision of her taken by cruel anger once before, a long time ago. He couldn't afford to suffer the distraction of any such memory right then and shoved it out of his mind. This was about Kaylin and about the future, not about the past. Richard pulled the baldric off over his head and gathered it together with the scabbard. Samuel, not far behind his mistress's skirts, stood quietly watching, his greedy eyes riveted on the wire-wound hilt. Holding the gleaming gold and silver scabbard in both hands, bundled together with the ancient tooled leather baldric, Richard lifted it out to Shota. She made no move to take it.
The sword belongs to Samuel, my loyal companion.
She smiled triumphantly.
Give it to him.
Richard stood frozen. He couldn't let Samuel have the Sword of Truth. He just couldn't. He wondered then just what he thought Shota would want with the sword, if not to give it to Samuel. He guessed that he had been trying not to think of what it really meant to hand it over to Shota. But the sword made him like that. Zed told me that the sword's magic did that to him, turned him into what he is now.
And when he has back what belongs to him, he will be who he once was before it was stolen from him by your grandfather.
Richard knew Samuel's character. As far as Richard was concerned, Samuel was capable of anything, including murder. Richard could hardly give something so dangerous as the Sword of Truth to someone like that. Too many people like Samuel had carried the sword, had fought over it, stolen it from one another, sold it to the highest bidder, who then became a seeker whose services were for sale to any loathsome cause that could pay the price. In the shadows, it passed from hand to hand, used for vile and violent purposes. By the time Zed had finally gotten the Sword of Truth back and eventually given it to Richard, the Seeker had become an object of scorn and contempt, seen as nothing more than a criminal, and a dangerous one at that. If he gave the sword to Samuel, it would be that way again. It would start all over again. But if he didn't, then Richard had no chance of ever stopping the far greater threat very likely loose in the world, or of ever seeing Kaylin again.
While Kaylin was of paramount importance to him personally, he was convinced that her disappearance augured an ominous menace far more sinister, with potential harm on a scale he feared to contemplate. His responsibility as the seeker of truth was to the truth, not to the sword of truth. Samuel inched closer, his eyes on the sword, his arms reaching, his palms held up, waiting.
"Mine, gimme!"
Samuel growled impatiently, his hateful eyes glaring. Richard lifted his head to look at Shota. She folded her arms, as if to say that this was his last chance. This was the last chance Richard had of ever finding the truth. If he had known of any other way to find a solution, no matter how remote that chance might be, he would have taken the sword back and taken that chance instead. But he couldn't lose this chance, lose what information Shota had. There was nothing else to do. With trembling hands, Richard lifted the sword out. Samuel, unwilling to wait the final seconds until it reached him, lunged and snatched the sword away, finally clutching the coveted object to his breast. The instant he had it, a strange look came over his face. He glanced up into Richard's eyes with his own wide with wonder, his mouth hanging agape. Richard couldn't imagine what Samuel was seeing as a result of having his hands on the Sword of Truth. Richard thought that perhaps he was simply awestruck to realize that he actually did have it again. He suddenly skittered away, swiftly disappearing into the trees. The Sword of Truth was once again among the shadows. Richard felt naked and stunned. He stared off in the direction Samuel had gone. He wished now that he had killed Shota's companion the first time Samuel had attacked him. Samuel had attacked Richard more than once. Richard had let those chances slip away. He turned a harsh glare on Shota. "If he harms anyone, it will be on your head." "I am not the one who gave him the sword. You did so of your own free will. I did not twist your arm or use my powers to force you. Do not try to shed responsibility for your own choices and actions. And I am not responsible for his actions. If he harms anyone, I will see to it that this time he pays for his crimes." Shota glanced off among the trees dotting the sweep of grass. "There is no one here for him to harm. He has his sword. He is happy now." Richard seriously doubted that. With quiet fury, he turned his attention to the matter at hand. He didn't want to hear any more of her excuses, so he came right to the point. "You have your payment." She stared at him a long time, her face unreadable. Finally, in a quiet voice, she spoke a single word. "Chain fire." She turned and started toward the road. Richard seized her arm and turned her back. "What?" "You wanted what I know that can help you find the truth. I have given it to you. Chainfire." Richard was incredulous. "Chainfire? What does that mean?" Shota shrugged. "I have no idea. I only know that it is what you need to know to find the truth of all this." "What do you mean you have no idea? You can't just tell me some word I never heard of and then leave. That's not a fair trade for what I've given you." "Nonetheless, that is the agreement you made, and I have upheld my end of the bargain." "You have to tell me what it means." "I don't know what it means, but I do know that it is worth the price you paid." Richard couldn't believe that he had agreed to a deal in which he got nothing of value in return. He was no closer to finding Kaylin than he had been before he'd come to see Shota. He felt like sitting down right there on the ground and giving up. "Our business is concluded. Goodbye, Richard. Please leave. It will be dark soon. I can assure you, you would not like to be here when it gets dark." Shota started down the road toward her palace in the distance. As he watched her go, Richard reprimanded himself for embracing failure without even trying for success. He now knew something linked to the mystery. It was a piece of the puzzle, a piece of the solution, so valuable that it had previously been known only to a witch woman. It confirmed for him that Kaylin was real. He told himself that he was a step closer. He had to believe that.
Shota!
Richard called. She paused and turned back, waiting to hear what he might say, looking like she expected a tirade.
Thank you, he said in a sincere voice. I don't know what good knowing the word chainfire will do me, but thank you. You have at least given me a reason to go on. When I came here, I had none. Now I do.
Thank you. She stared at him. He could not imagine what she could be thinking. Finally, she took a slow step back toward him. She clasped her hands before herself, looking down a moment before she stared off at the trees, apparently considering something. At last she spoke. What you seek is long buried.
Long buried? He cautiously asked.
Like the word chainfire, I can't tell you what that means. Things come to me in regard to issues, problems, questions. I am the carrier of the information, the channel, you might say. I am not the source. I can't tell you the meaning, but I can tell you that what you seek is long buried.
Chainfire, and seek something long buried, Richard repeated as he nodded. Got it. I'll not forget.
Her brow twitched, as if something else had just come to her. You must find the place of the bones in the deep nothing.
Richard felt goosebumps raising up his legs. He had no idea what the deep nothing was, but he didn't like the sound of it, or the sound of looking for bones. He refused to consider the dire implications. Shota turned again to the road and started making her way toward her palace. She had not gone more than a dozen paces when she stopped and turned back. Her ageless eyes met his gaze.
Beware the viper with four heads.
Richard cocked his head expectantly. I don't know what that means, the viper with four heads.
Whether or not you realize it right now, I have given you a fair trade. I have given you the answers you needed. You are the seeker, or at least you were. You will have to seek the meaning to be found in those answers.
With that, she turned for the final time and walked off through the golden light down the long road. Let's go, he said to Kara. I'd not like to find out why we don't want to be here when it gets dark. Kara cast him an icy glare. I would imagine it has something to do with a murderous maniac wielding a deadly sword coming at you from out of the darkness. Richard gloomily supposed that she might be right. Samuel would probably not be content to simply have the sword. He would probably want to eliminate the rightful owner and thereby any chance that Richard might lay claim to it, or somehow get it back. Despite what Shota had said, the real thief had been Samuel. The Sword of Truth was a responsibility of the first wizard. He was the one who named Seekers and gave them the sword. It did not belong to whoever might possess it by any means. It belonged to the true wizard named Seeker. And that was Richard. With sickening dread, he realized that he had betrayed the trust his grandfather had placed in him when he had given Richard the sword. But what value would the sword be to him if keeping it meant that Kaylin would lose her life? There was no higher value to him than life. Chapter 43. Richard was so deep in thought that he wasn't fully aware of the arduous climb up the steep face of the cliff and out of Agadon Reach. In the golden light of the valley below them, the long shadows of trees lengthened across the green fields, yet the quiet beauty of the place as the sun sank behind the enfolding mountains was lost on him. He wanted to be far away from the valley and out of the swamp before darkness took hold for good. He tried to devote his efforts to that task, that mission, of putting one foot before the other, of moving, advancing. By the time they reached the top of the cliff and the vast swamp, guarding the approach to Shota's home, it was an early dusk in the deep niche of the towering mountains that ring the place. Because the walls of rock cut the sunlight off early, it left the sky overhead a deep blue, but that light was unable to effectively penetrate the forest canopy, so that in the late day the vast green bog seemed mired in a perpetual gloom of half-night. The deep shadows were very different than those in Shota's valley. The shadows in the swamp concealed palpable but for the most part ordinary threats. The shadows around Shota concealed dangers that were not so easily appreciated, but that Richard suspected were far more pernicious. The sounds of the dank swamp all around him, the chirps, the whistles, the hooting calls, the clicks, the distant cries,
hardly registered in Richard's consciousness. He was deep in his own world of despair and purpose tangled together in a titanic struggle. While Shota had told him a great deal about the blood beast that was hunting him, Nikki had already told him that he was being hunted by a beast conjured at Jigang's behest. The visit to Shota had not been worth the minutiae he learned about the beast. It was the precious few things that Shota had said at the end that really mattered to him. It was those things for which he had traveled to this place. It was for those things he had paid a price so dear that he was only now beginning to fully grasp its significance. His fingers itched to touch the hilt of his sword for reassurance, but that familiar and faithful weapon was no longer there. He tried not to think about it, and yet he could think of little else. He felt relief that he had gained what he felt sure would be crucial information, but at the same time he felt a crushing sense of personal failure. He paid only enough attention to where he was walking to keep from stepping on a yellow and black banded snake he spotted coiled in the lap of a root, or letting the fuzzy spiders clinging to the underside of leaves silently slide down silken lines to alight on him. He skirted brush when something within hissed at him. Richard followed the darkening trail as fast as safely possible, while in his mind he went over Shota's every word, concentrating on the treasure for which he had paid such a terrible price. Kara followed close on his heels, swinging and swatting at the cloud of bugs hovering around their faces. Occasionally a bat fluttered in out of the dark shadows to snatch up some of those bugs. As he made his way through the tangle of growth, Richard pushed aside vines and branches and stepped carefully around snarls of roots, some of which writhed like a nest of snakes when they got too close. On his first visit, Samuel had shown him how those roots could grab an ankle if you got too close. Richard was so totally absorbed in trying to figure out what chain fire could possibly mean, or what it could be, that he nearly stepped into a stretch of black water that was hard to see in the murky light. Kara's hand snatching his arm halted him just in time. He glanced around and spotted the log they had crossed on before, and took to that route. He racked his brain trying to think if he had ever heard the word chain fire before, but his hopes grew as dim as the failing light. It was a strange enough word, it seemed, that he would have remembered it, if he had ever heard it before. He wished that Shota would have known its source or meaning, but he believed that she was telling the truth about these kinds of answers coming to her without explanation or insight. On the other hand, he feared that he knew all too well what Shota meant when she'd said, "What you seek is long buried." That warning made his chest ache. He dreaded that it very well might mean that Kaelin was already dead and long ago buried. He'd felt lost ever since that morning he awoke to find her missing. Without Kaelin, everything else in the world seemed meaningless. He couldn't allow himself to envision her death as being true. Instead, he thought about her beautiful, intelligent green eyes, her special smile, her singular manner as being very real and very alive. Shota's words, though, kept returning to him. He had to figure out what meaning they could hold if he was to find Kaelin.
This is the end of disc number 14. Please insert disc number 15.